In this last and final episode of the Monday Christian series, Paul Kim and Sib Sibanda discuss the potential and the limitations of capitalism as a redemptive force in society, in contrast to communism. Referring to practical examples in specific industries, they interrogate the concepts of human agency and direction of purpose, as well as the conditions necessary for a productive and prosperous society.
Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the final episode of the Monday Christian Podcast series, where we'll be discussing the potential and limitations of capitalism as a redemptive force in society. Paul, in many ways, this is a good follow-up to our previous podcast on work and rest, where we put forward this idea of pursuing shalom as a more holistic goal than, say, trying to find balance between work and life. And I say that because it provides us with a good reference point by which to assess both the benefits and limitations of capitalism, basically the degree to which it creates the conditions necessary for flourishing or for shalom. So with that as a backdrop, would you please define capitalism for the purpose of this discussion and perhaps contrast it with a communist approach to business and economics?
Happy to do so, Sibs. But before I do that, as you said, your intro, I just realized, you know, it's taken us this long to get to, let's call it a relevant topic. We had to build the foundation all the way from perspectives through those values. And now we've got the freedom to be able to speak about something that's deeply relevant in a society today. So it's it's a lot of work. I've got these definitions from a website called Key Difference, a really cool website. So firstly, capitalism. The key features of capitalism are individual rights, private property, accumulation of wealth, market economy, free and competitive market, self-interest, minimal government intervention. In a capitalist economy, it is the owners who decide and invest in the financial and capital market on the production inputs. The competition in the economy decides the price and distribution of merchandise in the economy.
Okay.
And communism, in this political system, the government owns everything and all the individual works for a common goal. Therefore, class distinction does not exist, as all are considered equal, some more equal than most. That's my side comment. Mm-hmm. Communism aims at removing the gap between the wealthy and poor and establishing equality in the economy.
Okay. So at face value, it doesn't exactly sound like there's one that's completely right and one that's completely wrong. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at communism's expressed ideals, it's like, you know what? Yeah, maybe we should act like a community and work together.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So I know you are a proponent of capitalism. So let's run it through that filter of shalom. To what extent would you say that capitalism can create the conditions necessary for flourishing? And would you go so far as to say it's the best model for doing so?
Before I give a perspective, let's kind of think through some of the facts about capitalism. So capitalism has been a tremendous force for good in our world and has allowed hundreds of millions, potentially billions of people to lift themselves out of poverty. But this isn't just about financial measurement. Real improvements have been made and the quality of life has improved significantly for many countries and their people. Running water, electricity, roads, payments infrastructure, access to medical services. Many countries have been able to move from a fragile subsistence economy to a more modern one through the deployment of capitalism. Many more people are employed and can actively pursue careers in industries that would never otherwise have been possible.
Are you saying then under communist philosophy or theory, we don't see these same things? Running water, electricity, roads?
So here's the thing, interesting thing about communism and the people that support that. Firstly, I don't think we have any real world anecdotes of communism succeeding at the full accounting of things. So after a couple of decades for a country. But the second thing that which I find ironic is that often when you have these debates, and I haven't had these debates, I've observed them, at some point the communist supporter will say, but that's not true communism.
Right.
So no one's actually ever done true communism to some extent. So we don't know if it is possible. But as it stands today, there is no anecdotal evidence that communism actually works and creates flourishing for people.
Okay.
There's an article I read recently from Acton University that I think the author was Isaac Willour. I've got a quote from him that kind of captures this well, this idea of capitalism doing good for the world. It's not foreign aid packages that are enabling millions of our fellow human beings to live richer and healthier lives, although charity and aid undoubtedly have their place. It's the free enterprise system that's doing this. It's innovation and entrepreneurship and capitalism that's doing this. We don't have to be naive, pretending capitalism is free of flaws or that the system isn't affected by inherent human selfishness. But it would be similarly naive to pretend that capitalism hasn't been a God-given tool that's done truly amazing things.
I know that statement will send chills down the spines of some listeners, putting capitalism and God-given, but let's have the conversation. That's what Monday Christian's about.
Yeah, and we'll get to the downside of capitalism soon. But I think to end off, let's assume that capitalism is a good thing. And to end off on a higher note, I think we mentioned in a previous episode, but the reverence for capitalism is probably best captured by the economist Milton Friedman. The Friedman doctrine is also referred to as the shareholder theory. American economist Milton Friedman developed the doctrine as a theory of business ethics that states that an entity's greatest responsibility lies in the satisfaction of the shareholders, not stakeholders, shareholders. Therefore, the business should always endeavor to maximize its revenues to increase returns for the shareholders. Now, if you go back to Genesis 1:28, going back to the Bible for a little bit, one of the instructions we're given is to be fruitful and to multiply. I've long thought about being fruitful in the population growth sense, but I've also recently come to understand that it speaks to yield or productivity. And capitalism definitely results in that. So yeah, sure. Capitalism does look like it's creating good for the world.
Okay. So I know we're going to come back to Friedman's quote later on. So we'll just let that one slide for now. But it goes without saying that like any model, capitalism has its limitations as a facilitator of flourishing, that is. So what in your view are those limitations and what are some of the consequences for exceeding them?
So let's start with the consequences and work back to the limitations because the consequences are very visible these days.
Yeah.
So I am a proponent of capitalism, but there are definitely things wrong with it. And unless we understand which conditions is capitalism a force for good, it would be like trying to put out a battery on fire with water, which results in explosion. So let's consider some of the dangerous and rotten fruit that capitalism has created. There's a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman that's doing the rounds in my network. And it's a fascinating book looking into behind the scenes activities that allows big countries and wealthy countries and organizations to basically enslave poorer developing countries. And the formula is absolutely crazy. So in a poor country or developing country, you send in these professionals that will then create these overly optimistic projections regarding economic growth as a result of infrastructure projects. And obviously the country looks at this and, wow, this is going to be good for us, our economic growth and our people. And the country doesn't have the money. So now they have to look to external organizations to get debt to fund it. And the listeners, if you read the book, will be aware of some of these organizations. But then after they get the funding, I mean, who's going to do the work? By definition, the poor country can't do it because they don't have the skills and the capacity. And so the work then gets done by US organizations, which then earn all the profit. So the profit gets siphoned off to existing wealthy country. And then they have local partnerships that become wealthy as well. These local partners are wealthy at the expense of the rest of the population and they keep these power dynamics intact. But then those predictions don't materialize. So then what happens is this poor country doesn't earn the revenue it needs to from these new projects and then gets enslaved to debt.
Yeah.
And that's a cycle that's repeated. And it's so amazing, but frightening to see that this is done so easily by the wealthy and the professional in our society. Another example would be South Africa, debt. The way that the capital markets or the private markets have done debt in this country is horrific. We have enslaved the majority of South Africans to lifetime of debt repayments and never being able to really be able to sustain yourself from your own income. Environmental destruction is taking place in an unprecedented level and we are destroying our forests, seas, atmosphere, and the air we breathe. In a number of countries across the world, the necessity for air purifier is a thing. The way we treat animals is perverse. On the one hand, a select number of animals are seen as pets for our enjoyment. And on the other hand, billions of animals are slaughtered on an annual basis in an inhumane way to feed our ever-growing appetite for meat. processed food is cheaper and tastier than their natural counterparts. And we end up destroying our bodies as a result and keeping them medicated to live longer. Not quality of life, we're just extending life, right? But we're in a hospital bed or we're on crutches or whatever is the case. In America, 9 of the 15 top killers can be reversed or reduced through lifestyle changes. In South Africa, non-communicable diseases, so diabetes, obesity, hypertension, continue to grow and burden our health system. And the scary thing about that is it's the cost of repairing a human can be infinitely more expensive than creating them and keeping them healthy. So blue-collar worker versus the cost of cancer treatment for that blue-collar worker. That blue-collar worker can never, ever pay that back. And so on and so forth. And the scariest one is probably just the very apparent income and wealth disparity. So Oxfam a couple of years ago did a study where it concluded the following. The world's richest 1% have more than twice as much wealth as 6.9 billion people. Nearly half of the world's population, 3.4 billion people, is living on less than $5.5 a day. Every year, 100 million people worldwide are pushed into poverty because they have to pay out of pocket for healthcare. In the US, of all places, the number one reason for bankruptcy is due to medical expenditure. Proverbs 11:10 says, when the righteous prosper, the city rejoices. When the wicked perish, there are shouts of joy. And I don't think that's taking place with our wealthy. We are not shouting for joy as our wealthy get wealthier, and there's something wrong.
So listening to that that list of negative consequences or impacts of capitalism, and just thinking, linking it back to the definition that you gave at the beginning for capitalism, I think the big phrase that jumped out at me was self-interest. And you can see how once you have self-interest in there, how a lot of these sort of ills of capitalism can come about. So it'll be interesting to see later on in the discussion how we look at this in a, from a redemptive point of view, given that one of the tenets of capitalism is self-interest, which in some ways is diametrically opposed to what scripture teaches. But let's crack on.
Let's dive into the understanding of the problem a little bit better then. So if you go back to Milton's theory, right? I mean, you can quickly kind of scratch through the superficial layer and realize that a singular focus on profit for shareholders is nonsensical. And the example that I want to use is if you have a vehicle, right? You need fuel to drive a vehicle to a destination. But imagine if the purpose of the vehicle was to keep filling up its tank. I mean, that would be nonsensical.
Yeah.
You fill up the tank in order to go somewhere. Mm. Obviously, it's necessary, but it's not the primary reason why you buy a vehicle. And so it's the same with profit. It's nonsensical for that to be the only reason why a company exists. The other reason why Milton's theory is flawed, and this is going on to your self-interest comment, is that the shareholders are not the only stakeholders in a business. And to narrowly focus on the shareholders completely ignores the fact that companies operate in a context and have many more stakeholders to be aware of. Some of these stakeholders benefit the company, so local municipality, and others are heavily influenced by the company's actions. You can imagine a local community for a mining company. And it just brings back to memory the conversation on God's sovereignty and man's responsibility. Like, no man is self-made, full stop. And again, no company is made by its shareholders only. In order to do the topic justice, we've got to be able to explain what's actually going on. Why is it sometimes good? Why is it sometimes bad? So let's start with communism. I think communism, in contrast to capitalism, doesn't work. I mean, there's no, unfortunately, positive examples of that, to my knowledge.
And we're saying doesn't work in terms of creating conditions necessary for flourishing, right? That's our baseline.
Yeah. Maybe not sufficient, but definitely necessary. Despite all the horrific examples I've given above in the capitalism part, there aren't really any anecdotal examples in human history of communism really working. So what does the Bible say to this? Does the Bible say anything as to why capitalism sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, and why communism never does? Well, I think it does. So,
or works to some degree.
Well, we can argue about that.
We probably could.
We could. And maybe we'll get to that in the next question. But here's my theory. So if you go back to Genesis 1, God, when mandating humans in Genesis 1 with a cultural or creational mandate, was implementing a model of stewardship. Stewardship, broken down, has two key parts to it: agency and direction. So I'll give you my definition of both. Agency, by which I mean the ability for humans to determine for themselves the purpose of their lives and the way they'd like to use it. Direction, by which I mean the North Star toward which they will apply their God-given agency. In the Bible, this is contrasted between two cities, the Tower of Babel or the New Jerusalem. We've spoken about this before. These represent the two kingdoms, the kingdom where we reign supreme or the kingdom where Jesus reigns supreme. An example I often use is planning a journey. Direction would be Harare in Zimbabwe or Windhoek in Namib, the two options. An agency is, on the one side, you must travel in public transport, or on the other side, you can determine for yourself how you get there. And you see this in real life, this dichotomy. So for some reason, I like watching drug trafficking documentaries. And there is incredible human ingenuity applied in drug trafficking. Like, you often walk away thinking, jeepers, if these guys did that, but in some positive aspect of the world, we'd be in a much better place.
Yeah.
Right? So there's agency there, but no direction, the wrong direction.
Got it.
The opposite is also probably true in SA government, where agendas other than skills are prioritized. There are very few government departments with a good reputation for service delivery. So direction, yes, for the good of the nation. Agency, no. That's, they commanded how to do things and they're not able to actually get the work done.
Okay, so I'm assuming the reason you brought up agency and direction was to make a pitch for capitalism. In other words, implying that capitalism helps to fulfill both of those, the agency and the direction, whereas communism doesn't. I'm not sure you've finished making that point. So how does communism not fulfill those two points?
So actually, I would suggest that communism fails because it doesn't have agency, and agency is the more important thing. Whatever God was going to do, he couldn't impinge on humans' free will. That was non-negotiable in the human creation project. Capitalism doesn't fulfill direction because capitalism in its own right doesn't give a direction. So that's where human agency comes in, to say man must submit to God or man can do it on its own self-interest. And so that's why we sometimes see, if man pursues capitalism, if you're a Christian, you know, if you're not a Christian, through common grace, sometimes you know, this is the direction for flourishing, then it creates a lot of good. But if done out of self-interest, it creates a lot of harm. Communism doesn't work because it doesn't meet the necessary requirement for agency in the first place. And so direction almost doesn't matter.
It takes away agency. It's disempowering.
Yes. And that's why it won't work.
Okay. All right. Well, as we come into land this episode, let's close out with a few thoughts on capitalism as a redemptive force in society. So as you've mentioned, human history is littered with catastrophic examples of capitalism gone wrong. But how can we as Christians and business harness this model for God's purposes and glory? And I assume it's got to do with something of that, the direction that you were talking about.
I think the place to start in order to understand the right place of capitalism is, how do we use the gift of capitalism that God has given us in a way that loves him, loves our neighbor, and loves creation? And to some extent, this whole podcast series was an attempt to answer this question for business owners. Capitalism needs the necessary guardrails to turn its potential power into a force for good. It's similar to fire. In a fireplace, it creates warmth, ambiance, and it's a beautiful sight to behold. Unrestricted in an open felt, in the heat of summer, leads to devastation and destruction. So the question is, what is the place of capitalism or the ideas underpinning capitalism in God's kingdom? And by starting from that perspective, one starts having an appreciation for the other gifts God has given us and the potential role they can play. For example, in health and education, I think we should be very careful when applying capitalistic principles to these bedrock parts of our society. I do not think it is wise to unleash the pursuit of unrestrained profit in health. And I'll give you a simple example. If as a medical practice or business, you make money when people are sick and you make more of it when they're sicker, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah.
Capitalism works really well in many instances because it taps into a core part of what it means to be made in the image of God. But at the same time, it is flawed because it does not recognize nor provide the necessary checks and balances to account for the sinfulness of man and man's desire to become God. That's why we need the other gifts, the justice system, for example. As we look for another economic model for flourishing for the world, we should return back to God's word to find our North Star, love. Love God, love neighbor. Let's start at the sources of truth and dive deep into the character of God and his mission in order to establish a model of flourishing in each domain of society, which includes the economic domain. Retrofitting God back onto a man-made model is like trying to put juice back into an orange. It doesn't work.
So let's just back up on that health example that you gave. So you said we should be careful when applying capitalistic principles to areas like health. Two questions. Firstly, what then should we be looking to do in areas like that? Secondly, who makes that call in society, right? So you could point at health, but I'm sure there's other industries, like say maybe insurance and all of that sort of thing, where one might traditionally point to capitalistic norms. But you could also equally say, well, there's dangers there, and someone could point to the benefits of taking a more communist approach to, say, insurance.
And this is why the concept of shalom is so important, integration, many role plays, working together, understanding each other's needs, in order to create a beautiful picture. And so we have to bring the government into play here. And yes, South African government has a very, very negative reputation at the moment. But for those of you who don't know, medical aid in this country is highly regulated. You probably know that part. The part that you don't know is under the principles with which it is regulated, this concept of solidarity. And it plays out in the young basically funding the old, and then the wealthy, and then the young and the healthy think, yo, why am I rate so high? But if it wasn't so, I can almost guarantee you your parents would not be able to afford medical aid. It would be so astronomically expensive if we didn't agree together that this is a social good and not everyone get priced based on who they are. I say this because you look at the US, because that's kind of more where they are. Medical insurance is basically unaffordable for many of Americans. There, I watched the John Oliver documentary the other day. I mean, he's a funny guy, very crass, unfortunately. But there was a lady they interviewed that basically said, I have to make a decision between heart medication, I can die at any time, or diabetes, I can die slowly. Mm. She has to make that choice. In South Africa, yes, you wait in a queue. Yes, the system's not working, but you never have to make that choice, right? So it's very important to understand what is the product, what are the incentives around it? And government does play a very important role saying, guys, here's the rules of the game, play within the space. Otherwise, the rest of society crumbles.
And so would you say then, because again, one of the tenets of capitalism is minimal government intervention, would you highlight the fact that it's minimal rather than the fact that it should be no government intervention? It sounds like, so in this healthcare example, you're recognizing the need for government and for some sort of communal approach to flourishing in society. And I'm trying to work out, are you actually pointing towards a hybrid between capitalism and communism? Or are you saying it's actually capitalism, but with the appropriate amount of government, quote, socialist intervention?
Yeah, so this is what I was trying to say about we can't retrofit God back onto a man-made idea. So, and just trying to understand how do we create flourishing for all stakeholders, you have to actually start with what is the problem and then what is the solution and who needs to get involved. Instead of just trying to describe it from, oh, this is capitalistic or this is communistic. So it's a spectrum, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it depends on the state of your people and the state of the economy. In a developing country, no private provider, I can assure you, is going to set up a clinic for two people in a village in the middle of nowhere.
Correct.
So then what do we do for those people? Do we tell them to die?
Yeah.
No. Government intervention is absolutely critical in those environments. But when it gets to a space where you've got a well-functioning economy, there's a healthy competition in the marketplace, then sure, you actually want that to become more capitalistic and less government intervention. So it requires a nuanced approach to say, what is the context? What is the problem? And then let's look at the various tools that God has given us to know what the right solution is.
Good. Yeah, I like that.
So yeah, just in closing, just an interesting observation that someone shared with me the other day. Jesus in Mark 12:29, when asked what is the greatest commandment, seems to be a repeat of a version of the Shema, which his Jewish hearers would be very familiar with. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4 to 5 is the Shema in its original state in the Old Testament. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. But here's the interesting thing. When Jesus repeats it in Mark, he adds, with all your mind. So let me read it for you. The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. As a new creation in Christ, we have a renewed stewardship agency brought by his death on the cross and guaranteed by his resurrection and ascension to the throne. Part of this means that we have a renewed mind, and that we can get to think about the world from the perspective of the Creator and King. We are not just robots. We can live out our lives with our own thoughts infused by the way that God wants us to live. And that is our renewed stewardship mandate that Christ died on the cross for.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking of, I think a comment you made earlier when you were talking about agency and direction. And so reading that text again, love your neighbor as yourself, right? So if you go back to the definition of capitalism, self-interest. Mm. So if I'm loving my neighbor as much as I love myself, right? Because God knows how much I love myself. Yeah. Then actually, in some ways, it's giving biblical direction to capitalism, right? Where capitalism is saying, love yourself. Jesus says, okay, cool. That's fine to love yourself. Just make sure you love your neighbor.
Yeah.
The same way.
Yeah. And we spoke about it, I think, in the previous episode, the second episode on rest, is those three parts. Love your neighbor as yourself. Then it's the creation mandate. And then it's the gospel mandate or the discipleship mandate. And if you have those three in the right order, intention, these questions become a lot easier to answer.
Yeah. Paul, thank you so much. I know it's a massive topic and there's no way we're going to exhaust it, but hopefully we've given our listeners enough to think about and have ongoing conversations, which again was the purpose of this series, to help Christians start thinking and engaging around God's word, his perspective on our day-to-day work and business. So thank you so much for all the time that you've given, all of the thought that you've put into this series. It's been a real pleasure spending this time with you. And I know it's been a great blessing to many.
Great. Yeah, it's been so much fun. Thanks, Sibs.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.